Today I want to talk to you a little bit about happiness and friendship and draw on a number of thinkers, but mainly draw on Aristotle. Now, when Aristotle talks about friendship in the Nicomachean Ethics, he does not mean anything like we would mean by a friend on Facebook. Aristotle is thinking about friendship as, in contemporary English, we might think of a best friend or an extremely close friend. He's thinking about friend in terms of someone that you maybe have three friends and no more. You couldn't have any more than, say, three friends. And he defines friendship very carefully. He kind of has remarks in different places, but I'm going to try to bring them together so that we have kind of a working definition of Aristotle's understanding of what a friend is. He says, first of all, that a friend has goodwill for us, for the friend, and for the friend's own sake. And this is important. I think this reflects our everyday understanding of friendship. So if you think, you may have had this experience where you thought someone was your friend until they, say, revealed some secret that you told them not to tell anyone, right? And then you might have said, oh my gosh, I thought so-and-so was my friend, but then they revealed the secret and they ruined my reputation or they did whatever, right? So a real friend is someone who has goodwill for you. And Aristotle says goodwill for your own sake. That is to say, it's not just that your friend does nice things for you, but he does nice things for your own good. A real friend is not like a farmer. A farmer might have goodwill for the pig, right? And keeps the, you know, the wolves away from the pig and makes sure the pig's fed and makes sure the pig doesn't get a disease. But the farmer wants what's good for the pig for the farmer's sake, right? So he can sell them at market and make a nice profit. He doesn't want what's good for the pig for the pig's own sake. By contrast, a real friend is like a good mother, right? A good mother wants what's good for her child for the sake of the child. And Aristotle thinks that's what a friend is. But to be a friend, you need more than goodwill. And part of the reason you need more than goodwill is that I could have goodwill for you and, you know, do nice things for you for your own sake. But if you don't reciprocate back to me, well, then we're not really friends. For Aristotle, friendship must always be mutual, right? It's a little bit like a marriage, right? If there's no husband, husband and wife go together. That is to say, you couldn't have one without the other. You can't be one person married. And friendship for Aristotle is like that. It's always mutual. So you need mutual goodwill. And moreover, he says it has to be known to both people, right? So you're both aware. I care about you for your own sake. You care about me for my own sake. And we're aware of this. He's not done. In addition to that, he thinks that you need some sort of shared activity, right? It's characteristic of friendship for Aristotle that people that are friends do something together. Now, what do they do? Well, it would depend on what kinds of friends they are and what they like to do. So you might have philosophy friends where you get together and you talk about predicate logic, or you might have bowling friends, right? You get together and you go bowling. You might have friends that you like to play volleyball on the beach. But the idea is there's some sort of shared activity, okay? Another characteristic of friendship for Aristotle is that real friends, he says, share a kind of emotional life together. That is to say, they share enjoyments, and they also share things that are distressful to them. So here's one way to think of it. Think of, say, your best friend. I'm sure if I told you, oh my gosh, your best friend just got into a terrible car accident, right? They may die, they're in terrible pain. That would pain you, right? You share with a good friend this sort of emotional life. And in a similar way, if you have a really good friend and something wonderful happens to them, they get into Baylor University, right? You're delighted for them, right? You share that with them, right? So friends are happy together. That is to say, they share this emotional life and they're sad together. And that's one of the reasons Aristotle thinks you can't have tons and tons and tons of friends. Right? Why? Well, because you don't have time for all this shared activity with tons and tons of people, nor could you possibly share an emotional life with tons and tons and tons of people. And the final characteristic I want to mention for Aristotle is that friendship requires time. For Aristotle, it's impossible to instantly be friends. It's definitely possible to instantly want to be friends or act in a friendly way towards someone or hope that you'll be friends. But for Aristotle, you can't actually instantly be friends. It takes time to have this shared activity. You have to get to know the other person really well. He says in one passage, you have to share a peck of salt, with a person, to be for that person to really be considered your friends. And how much is a peck of salt? Some scholars say it's about 8 pounds of salt, right? So imagine going to In-N-Out with someone so many times that you went through 8 pounds of salt, right? That would take, what, 10 times at least. I mean, so that's what Aristotle means by friend. And maybe his definition's correct, maybe it's not, but let's work with it, just provisionally, and see where it takes us. Aristotle's next move is to say this, that we love in a friend, we love our friend because our friend is lovable, right? And then he says, well, there are three different things that people find lovable. People find lovable things that are pleasurable, right? Everybody loves a good meal, right? Good wine, to enjoy yourself. That's something we all love. Secondly, we love things that are useful, right? Imagine you love your iPhone. Imagine you love your computer. You love your car, right? We love things that are useful. We love money, right? It helps us get things. And then thirdly, Aristotle said that we love things that are excellent, right? And that's the word there, excellent, is the Greek is arete. And it's sometimes translated as virtue, but it does mean a kind of excellence, right? A virtuous person is an excellent person on Aristotle's view. So we have this, therefore, three kinds of friendship. And imagine if you think about your own life, that you could think about your own friends in terms of these three kinds of friendship, right? If you think about your life. I remember the very first time I read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, I thought back to my sophomore year of high school. And when I was 16, my grandfather took me out and he bought me this used black Mustang. And it was a real beater car, but I was absolutely delighted, right? I was the second guy in my high school class to get my license in a car. And I was so happy that I can't even tell you. And sophomore year was great. I was driving all these people around and they'd call me up, hey, Kayser, let's go to the Arboretum. Hey, Kayser, there's this party. Hey, go here and go there. And I was driving them all around and it was absolutely terrific. But then something happened. They started to turn 16, and they started to get cars. And all of a sudden, I'm at home, sitting by the phone, no cell phones in those days, and the phone's not ringing anymore, right? I'm like, well, where'd Pat go? He never calls me anymore. Well, Pat got his own license. He's off driving by himself. And so basically, all these people who I thought were my friends were just gone. They just kind of abandoned me. And I didn't know what happened. I didn't have the language to really articulate what happened until I read Aristotle. And I realized, oh my gosh, this is what he means by a friend of utility, right? I was very useful when I was the only one with a car and a license and they, you know, driving them all around. But then once they got their license and their car, well, I wasn't useful anymore. And once the utility was gone, that was the end of the friendship. Aristotle was onto something. If our friendships are based simply on utility, on a kind of exchange, almost like a business relationship, then that sort of friendship is going to be short-lived. And the reason is that what's useful tends to shift over time, right? If you're here studying physics, and maybe you're not so good at physics, it might be very useful to be friends with somebody else in class who's an ace at physics, right? But once the semester's over, if that's all your friendship's based on, well, that's the end of the friendship, right? And you won't be friends with them anymore if that's all that it was about. Aristotle also points out that friendships of utility aren't based really on the person. In other words, it's not really that you care about this person. It's more that you really care about the things, say, rides or physics lessons or whatever, that the person gives to you. And so he says these sorts of friendships tend to be fragile. They tend to be prone to disagreements. Because these sorts of friendships really are a little bit like a business deal with no contract. Right? You don't really spell out explicitly, well, I'll be friends with you, you drive me around, I'll be friends back, and I'll help you with the physics. I mean, it's not, you know, you don't formalize it. And so both parties tend to say, aha, I'm giving more than I'm getting. Right? And so when both parties feel that way, they say, fine, forget it, I'm out of here, I'm not going to be friends anymore. Friendships of utility. I also understood when I read Aristotle about what he called a friendship of pleasure. So everyone enjoys pleasure. But Aristotle pointed out that if our friendships are based just on pleasure, on partying, on having fun, on drinking, things like that, that those friendships also tend to be very short-lived. Now, what's the reason for that? Well, Aristotle notes that our pleasures tend to shift over time, right? I mean, think back in your own life. Think back when you were, I don't know, a grade school kid. right? I imagine you like to do things like, I don't know, go to the playground and play kickball and, I don't know, maybe things like that. And then when you got to college, I doubt you're still doing that. And then once you get to be older, if you're lucky enough to have kids, you will, I guarantee it, get immense pleasure out of chasing your children around and playing monster, right? You will. You will think this is so fun. And this is true of what human beings take pleasure in. It tends to shift. And again, Aristotle noted that if you have a friendship of pleasure, it is not really about the person, but rather about the pleasure, as it were, that they're giving you. I experienced this in my life, too. My best friend, probably freshman year of college, was this guy, I'll call him Sean. And Sean and I were on the Boston College track team. And he was in the honors program with me, and he was a great guy. So we had tons in common, right? We were running track together. We were about equally, you know, good at, as runners. And he was really smart. I think he was valedictorian of his high school class. And we really had this great friendship that involved running in school. And, you know, we lived near each other, et cetera. And we used to go out and drink and have a lot of fun. But as college went on, he started not just drinking, but also doing drugs. Right? First a little pot, a little this and that. But then as time went on, he started doing even more, right? And we just sort of drifted apart. And then senior year, he called me in a panic. It was a couple weeks before graduation. And he called me up and said, "Chris, I need your help desperately. I know you know some people in the administration of the school. And my brother and I got really drunk last weekend. We got into a fight with the university police. My brother put one of the police officers in the hospital with a broken back. And now this is weeks before graduation, we're getting expelled from school. Can you help me?" And I tried to help him. I said, talk to the people I knew. And I said, this is, you know, I knew this guy really well freshman year. And, you know, I tried to intercede a little bit, but they got expelled. And on our graduation day, he was working as a delivery boy in Boston, riding a bike around, delivering packages, right? So friendship of pleasure can go south pretty fast, and it tends not to be very long-lasting. So what's the last kind of friendship that Aristotle talks about? Well, that's a friendship of virtue. And virtue for Aristotle is an excellence of character. And Aristotle talks in particular about four main virtues. And those are courage, which is, you might boil it down to, doing the right thing despite difficulties and fear. There's practical wisdom, which is knowledge of what to do in the concrete circumstances to really make things as good as they can be. We can talk about temperance, which is enjoying bodily pleasure, but never in such a way that it undermines doing what's right and living an upright life. And then the final cardinal virtue of justice, which is giving to each what is due to each. Now, Aristotle notes that unlike what happens to be pleasurable at the moment, and unlike what happens to be useful in the moment, what's virtuous is something that's long-lasting. And the reason it's long-lasting is that virtue is a habit. I mean, all of you have the habit of speaking English. And so this is a deeply ingrained ability that you have that's a lasting sort of thing. I mean, if we took you to China and, you know, you were in China for the next 3 years, yes, your English might get rusty over the course of time, but you still would, you know how to speak English because it's a deeply ingrained habit. And so Aristotle noted, look, if you love someone because of who they are, because of their character, that is going to be a very long-lasting and solid kind of love. Because what you care about in the person is something that's long-lasting and solid, this lasting habit. Okay, now where does Aquinas come in? Let me complicate things a little bit. All this so far has been Aristotle, but Aquinas comes in the following way. Aquinas thought there was, you might say, a fourth kind of friendship, and that would be a friendship of infused virtue. What does that mean? Well, I talked before about how Aristotle defines friendship in terms of these characteristics, and Aquinas thought that friendship was possible not just between human beings, but also with God. So Aristotle famously says that because there's such a great inequality between God and, God and human beings, that really there could be no friendship. There's no communication between them. They're too radically different, right? And Aristotle definitely has a point. But it's possible, which he didn't see, for God to bridge that gap, you might say, for God to communicate with us. It might be impossible for you to become friends with a pope or a prime minister or a president, But if the Pope, Prime Minister, or President called you and said, hey, I want you to come to the White House or to the Vatican or whatever, I want to be friends with you, well then, given that initiative from the person who's above, you could establish a kind of friendship. And just as a friendship with a regular human being involves those characteristics of mutual goodwill, so too, friendship with God involves that characteristic of mutual goodwill. That is to say, God, on his part, always has goodwill for us, right? So that part's always met. And we can have goodwill back for God. We can have shared activity with God. What would that mean? Well, at least the Christian God is a God that is loving human beings, right? That is doing good things in the world, right? And we can share in that activity. We can sign on, as it were, to be co-participators in that activity, right? We can share with God distresses and enjoyment. Well, what does that mean? Well, Scripture sometimes speaks of, in the metaphor of God becoming angry and God becoming distressed over the sins and wrongdoings of others, and God rejoicing in things that are good. And in the human being Jesus, of course, he had all the range of normal human emotions, you know, positive emotions over things that are positive and negative emotions over things that are negative. So the person who's a friend of God shares in those proper, that proper emotional orientation, you might say. So, for Aquinas, at least, we can be friends with God. We can have this friendship of infused virtue. Most of the virtues, of course, we gain through what? In Aristotle's view, through repeated action. Right? If I want to be courageous, I have to repeatedly do courageous things. If I want to be temperate, I have to repeatedly do temperate things. But for Aquinas, the infused virtues, the key difference is these are, in his view, gifts from God. God gives us these virtues. So it'd be something like this. If you wanted to become physically strong, right, you can go to the gym and work out with weights. And if you did that enough, you'd be habituated enough, you'd get stronger and stronger. But another way to get strong would be if a surgeon made you the bionic man or the bionic woman or something, right, infused strength into you from the outside, as it were. And that's Aquinas' understanding of this infused virtue. Okay. So let me say a word about Aristotle asked this interesting question. Can bad people, are bad people friends with themselves? Right? Is a bad person a friend with himself? Is a bad person a friend with herself? Let me say a word about that. We have different dimensions to our personality, right? Different dimensions of who we are. And Aristotle thought it's possible for us to be friends with ourselves, or it's possible for us not to be friends with ourselves, these different dimensions of ourselves. So what is it to be a friend to ourselves? Well, if we were a friend to ourselves, we'd will what's really good for ourselves, right? And so a bad person, though, doesn't will what's really good with themselves. Let me tell you a different story about another friend. This is a guy that I grew up with. And when we were kids and stuff, we used to horse around and drink a lot of beer and have fun and stuff like that. And again, this is a really sad story. He kind of continued down that road, you might say. Right? And so he got into drugs, and he got through two divorces, and his life just kept on getting out of control. And then finally, he was driving along the I-10 in going from Seattle down south, and he ended up rear-ending this truck and ended up dying. He wasn't a friend to himself, right? He wasn't a friend to himself. He didn't treat himself as someone that like someone he cared about, right? He let his addictions, he let his drug abuse and alcohol abuse spiral out of control. And that's why, and partly, I think that this topic of friendship is so important, because we do have some control over the course of our lives. Not perfect, of course. But each one of you has immense control in terms of choosing who your friends are. And if you choose badly, your friends will influence you. You might think, oh, no, I'm not going to be influenced by my friends. I mean, we do stuff, but I'm kind of insulated. I'm not going to go down the bad road the way some people go. And I think if we think that way, we're kidding ourselves. Human beings are designed to be social beings. We have, as you probably know in our mind, something called mirror neurons, which basically means we look around all the time and we take into account what other people are doing and adjust our behavior accordingly. Right? I mean, think about fashion. Right? If you had a picture of a, you know, college auditorium 100 years ago, everyone would be dressed really differently, right? And I'm sure 100 years from now, they'll dress differently then, right? And why is it that this happens? Well, there's no law, right? It's a matter of people wanting to fit in. And so when we choose our friends, we're choosing more than just people to spend time with. We're choosing people that are shaping us. We're choosing people that willy-nilly are going to influence us for better or for worse, right? And so that's why the choice of friends is incredibly important, right? We can ask ourselves, is this person a mere friend of pleasure, a friend of utility, a friend of virtue, or maybe even a friend of infused virtue, right? It's extremely important. Now, Aristotle's view, I think, is important in another way. Because if his view is correct so far, it turns out that bad people are bad friends. Right? Let me say that again. Bad people make bad friends. Why? Well, a bad person for Aristotle would be a person who's lacking the good qualities I talked about. Right? Lacking justice, lacking courage, lacking temperance, lacking practical wisdom. So if you make some friends with someone who's a bad person, what does that mean? Well, that means they'll give you what's due to you whenever they feel like it, right? They're not a just person. They don't have the habit of doing this. They're going to do it whenever it suits them. And if it doesn't suit them, if it suits them to harm you, steal from you, take from you, whatever, well, that's what they're going to do, right? A bad person is lacking the virtue of temperance. So what does that mean? Well, that means if enjoying pleasure is going to cause you harm, they're not going to stop, right? Maybe they'll drive drunk with you in the car or something, right? But if they're lacking temperance, what that means is they enjoy bodily pleasure regardless of how it affects others. And if it adversely affects you, tough luck. Sorry about that. I got to get my booze. I got to do whatever. And if it adversely affects you, that's just too bad. The bad person is lacking courage, right? So what does that mean? Well, that means if you really need help sometime, your back's against the wall, you're desperate, you better not call this person. Right? Because when the going gets tough, they say, I'm really sorry that happened to you, but I'm too busy. I got my party to go to. I can't help you. See you later. Right? And they're lacking practical wisdom. And what does that mean? That means that even if they wanted to help you, even if they had the good intentions, which they don't, they are going to be unable to really help you. They're literally not even going to know what to do. They don't have practical wisdom. They can't take into account the concrete situation and say, aha, in this situation, I should do this or that. They have no clue, right? The bad person is selfish. And so they don't really care about you, right? So we choose our friends, but then our friends shape us. Our friends influence us. Our friends really help cause our life to be what it is. And so I'd ask you to think very carefully when you make friends. College is such a great time in part because every semester almost is a new beginning, right? Here we are at the beginning of the semester. Some of you, you're at the beginning of your college experience, right? You have new classes. You've got a whole sea of people that are potential friends, right? And you can make terrific friends. When I think of some of my friends from college, the ones that weren't friends of pleasure or friends of utility, these people I'm still friends with. I talked to one of them today on the phone, right? You can be friends with them 30 years later, good friends with them. Right? And if you're very fortunate, you might even be able to marry one. Right? The divisions of friendships that I talk about also apply to the relationship between husband and wife. You could have a marital friendship of pleasure, in which case I'd also arrange for a good divorce attorney because it's probably not going to last very long. Right? You can have a marital friendship of utility. Same thing. You need the divorce attorney there. But you could also choose a marital friendship of virtue. If you find somebody who is a solid person, who's got these good virtues, etc., I'd advise you not to date the person via the kind of style that you see in The Bachelor, right? This is not going to help, right? The Bachelor is a great way to secure marital friendship with pleasure, maybe, but that's about it, right? What you should do is you should volunteer to babysit for some young family that's got 4 or 5 kids and tell the couple, hey, you and your wife, you go out. I'm going to watch the kids. Don't worry about paying us money. We'll take care of that and see how this person does. Right? Are they patient? Are they kind? Are they generous? If they are, that sounds like a keeper. Aquinas suggested Aristotle in certain ways, and one of the most important ways was in terms of this topic of the friendship between husband and wife. Aristotle thought that it was an unequal friendship, a kind of aristocracy with the man being great and the woman not. But Aquinas disagreed. He thought of friendship as an association of equals. He thought that Eve was created from the side of Adam, because if she had created from his head, that would indicate superiority over Adam. If she was created from his feet, that would indicate that she's a kind of servant, a kind of slave. But the fact that she's made from his side means that she's his companion, an equal. He thought that the friendship between husband and wife could be the greatest kind of friendship, because it's the deepest sort of shared activity you can have with someone, the creation of new life and the nurturing of new life. College is a great time to look for that person, and it's a great time to look for friends that can last your whole life long. So look carefully. Be wise. Think about people that have these virtues. And if you do, Aristotle thinks, and Aquinas thinks, and all the contemporary research also shows that your life is going to be enhanced immeasurably. People focus on wealth in terms of money. I mean, wealth in terms of happiness. And it is true that you need money to be happy. But all the psychological research points to the same conclusion, that once you're out of dire poverty, once you have three meals a day and a place to sleep and things like that, then additional amounts of money really makes no significant difference. But you know what makes a huge difference? Is deep friendship. The Harvard study, the Grant study at Harvard University, traced undergraduates over the course from about 20 years old all the way till they died. So it was this multi-generational kind of study. And at the end of it, they looked at all the factors that made life good and, you know, why some people's lives were great and why some people's lives were horrible. And at the end, the lead researcher concluded, they said, well, you know, what'd you learn from all these, you know, 70 years of doing research and all the millions of dollars spent? And he said, I can summarize it for you very quickly. He said, happiness is love, full stop. Right? Happiness is love, full stop. And that's why Aristotle, I think, was absolutely right, that no one would want to live without friends. Thank you very much.
Well, we have plenty of time for questions for Professor Kayser, so who would like to get us started?
Outside of simply happiness, does Aristotle or Aquinas discuss what the importance of friendship is in shaping someone developmentally or as part of a community?
Yeah, so Aristotle has remarks that basically different stages of life are inclined to different kinds of friendship. So he thinks young people are more inclined to pleasure than people that are older, and so they're more inclined to have what we've talked about as a friendship of pleasure. And he also says, and I think there's good evidence for this, that young people have tend to make friendships more quickly. Right, so they tend to meet people and make plans and start doing things together, and so their friendships tend to blossom more quickly. And the older we get, the less that tends to happen. Friendship, this is an Aristotle, but contemporary psychology points out that for men in particular, in our culture, there's a real problem with friendship. So most women in our culture still do have friends. So they get together with other 30, 40, 50-year-old women, and they do stuff, and they chat, and they have a book club, and they do whatever. But lots of men in our culture really have just their wife as their friend, or maybe even no one as a friend, right? They lose touch with their old college and high school, you know, roommates and friends and stuff. And then at work, they maybe have a kind of buddy a little bit, but not really. They don't do much outside of work. And this is a very serious problem. It literally kills people. Right? There's lots of research that loneliness is literally deadly for people. And for men, it's a greater problem than women, and that's part of the reason that men tend to die on average younger than women do. So the developmental path seems to be something like this, that early in development, you know, teenager kids and stuff and in college, more inclined towards friendships of pleasure and developing friendships quickly, but then also dissolving friendships more quickly. And then as you age, your friend group tends to narrow a little bit. And then, unfortunately, it tends to be a fact for men, friendships really tend to get narrow, and that's very, very unfortunate for men.
You were speaking of you kept it somewhat one-sided in how we are influenced by the friends we make, and how if you're a good friend and you have a bad friend, you would end up being influenced by that
That's a good question. So I do think the sociality of human existence means that we influence each other. So, and this is true aside from friendship. I mean, if you look at smoking, right? If one person in a friend group starts smoking, the likelihood that other people are going to start smoking goes up. But the same thing's true the opposite direction, right? If there's a bunch of people that smoke and then one gives it up, it's more likely the other ones will give it up also. So the direction or the causality is sort of mutual. The thing is, though, I would say it's very dangerous to think, oh, I'm going to rescue this friend. And the reason it's really dangerous is that there are many people who do not want to be rescued. And so it is doomed. You're doomed. It's not going to work to say to your friend who's abusing drugs, like, hey, you know, I'm going to try to get you to stop abusing drugs or whatever. Right? In fact, I don't think that hardly ever works. So what is more likely to happen is that person tries to influence you. Why? Well, because they feel a little bit guilty. They know what they're doing isn't quite right. And if they can drag you down with them, their guilt is made a little easier to handle. Right? If everyone's doing something, you can kind of talk yourself into the idea, well, it can't be that bad, can it? So unfortunately, what often happens is the lesser friend, the bad person, influences the good person. But I think you're right. It can go both ways. But I definitely would shy away from it. I don't think it's very wise to think of friendship as a rescue operation, like this person's so messed up, I'm going to save them from their drug addiction. I think that it's really tough to make that work.
Question here.
Yeah. That's a good question. So Aristotle thinks that the virtues, like courage, are things that can be cultivated, but also that some people start off, you might say, further down the road than others. So for instance, you might have somebody who just has a temperament or disposition that they're not as fearful as other people. And then you might have someone who's kind of excessively fearful, just by nature. Now, wherever we start by nature, we can grow. So it's a little bit like strength. Right? Some kids are just kind of strong kids. Some kids are not so strong. But everyone, if you go to the gym and work out consistently, everyone can get way, 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 way stronger than they were initially. But Aristotle does think that both your temperament, kind of the nature that you had, and also, this is key for Aristotle, the way you were raised. So if you were raised really well, and your parents helped you not be excessively fearful and helped you not to enjoy bodily pleasures in ways that get in the way of your flourishing, well, then you're way ahead. Aquinas adds another kind of dimension. And the dimension is that for Aristotle, you could get someone who's kind of hopeless, right? They're so bad, and they've got these terrible habits, and they're raised poorly, and they're, you know, nothing can be done, really. But Aquinas' idea was that God's grace can, even for someone who's really got serious problems, can be transformative. Right, so you could get people like Saul or something who was going down one road, got knocked off his horse, and went on a totally different path. So there's more for Aquinas. There's much more hope, you might say, for someone who's really not doing very well in terms of the virtues, because there's the infused virtues that God would transform someone, and it wasn't just a matter of their habits. Whereas for Aristotle, if you've got really bad habits, is it possible to turn over a new leaf? Yes, definitely. But it would be a little bit like if you had smoked, you know, 3 packs of cigarettes for 20 years. Could you stop smoking? You can. I mean, I know people who've stopped smoking that had a huge smoking habit, but it's very challenging, extremely hard. And, it's going to be a real struggle. Possible, yes, but you're really uphill battle. Yeah.
Question. So I know the ethics. There's a section about proximity. Maybe that's in the same vein as a shared activity. But I was wondering, in a world where we increasingly have long-distance friendships that we keep up via technology, how do you think Aquinas or Aristotle would feel about that? Is it true friendship, or...?
Well, I think it depends. So I think you... I don't think... I don't think you could have the fullest sense of Aristotelian friendship without actual physical proximity. And part of the reason for that is he actually has remarks about friendships flourishing when people live together, right? And so I think he's thinking of, you actually are in the same place with the person like every day, see them at breakfast and do activities with them all day long. You know, think about a husband and wife that are together and doing stuff all the time. That, I think, is the kind of paradigm case of friendship. So if you had that with someone and then you moved away, it seems to me you could keep up somewhat the relationship, electronically and virtually. But I do think that it would kind of fade over time, that friendship is reinforced and flourishes most when there's actual physical face-to-face, you know, activity together. And therefore, I don't think that you could have a friendship in the full Aristotelian sense that was merely virtual. In other words, I met the person online, I've never met them, etc., but we're friends. Well, I don't think you could be Aristotelian friends if that's all it was.
So how do you think we're supposed to deal with that? Like, in an age where that happens more and more, especially like here in college,
yeah.
How do you think we're supposed to handle that?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong at all with keeping up with friends, you know, through social media. But I think the trouble would be is if you substituted that for actual face-to-face contact, actual live human interaction. So, in other words, you could have people, there are definitely people who, their social time is enveloped with, online and on phones and whatever. And that, it seems to me, would be the problem. But you could do that online stuff to a degree, but also make time, significant time, regular time, for kind of normal face-to-face interactions where you go bowling with people or you play volleyball with them or you talk philosophy with them or whatever you like to do with them. But I do think, and there's actually empirical evidence too, that human interactions are really different if they're in person and face-to-face. And part of the reason is that human communication, whenever you are televised or just your voice is recorded, you're not getting the full communication, as it were. Because a lot of communication is body language and facial things. And it's even hard to articulate exactly what you're getting, but you do get something more, richer, when you actually are talking to somebody, looking in the eye, and they're talking to you, and you're interacting in a real-time, face-to-face sort of way. So social media is fine, but it's no substitute for actual, real, face-to-face contact.
I
do think that friendship involves doing those sorts of things that I said Aristotle said was necessary for friendship. So, for instance, shared activity. Everyone is busy, right? There's no one here who's like, oh, I've got, you know, all the time in the world. We're all busy. We've got things we have to do. But part of being a friend is maintaining those sorts of activities, right? Making time for, oh, we're going to go bowling. We're going to play volleyball. We're going to go hiking. We're going to do whatever we're going to do. Because if you don't schedule things in and you don't make time for it, then it's very easy that it just never happens. And that includes, you might say, sharing your emotional life with someone. So again, this is, I think, part of the reason that men tend to have fewer friends than women do. So sometimes men are afraid or hesitant to share things that are painful or setbacks or, you know, failures and things like that. They seem to be, on average, more reticent to do that than women are. But I think that's a mistake, because friends, at least for Aristotle, are supposed to share this sort of emotional life together. Again, not like you use this person as a therapist or something, but to be honest with a person, right, about how your life is going. That seems like it's kind of part of what a real friend is. And but yeah, I'd say the making deliberate time to be with the people. And the easiest way to do that, I find, is if you have some kind of shared activity that you're doing with these people regularly. So, like, I have some friends that we do martial arts together. And, like, that Sunday we go do martial arts and we're horrible. You know, people are looking at me like I'm Bruce Lee. No, I'm horrible. But it's fun. It's fun. You know, it's kind of exercise and you learn a few things. But that's our little fun activity together. Right, and we do it not every Sunday, but try to do it every Sunday, and so we have this regular time to work out and practice these things. And so I don't think it really matters what you're doing. It could be chess, it could be riding a bike, it could be just taking a walk on the beach, it could be whatever you want. But if it's not kind of a regular part of your life, right, if it's like, oh, every Christmas I do something with you, well, no, that's not enough. It can't be once a year thing. It has to be, you know, part of your regular everyday life. And this also fits into this friendship with God, right? So if we want to be friends with God, it can't be like, well, oh, I go to church on Sunday, or I go once in a while. Well, no. I mean, if you're really friends with God, the idea is it's a regular, everyday kind of thing that you are praying, communicating with God, etc., rather than a kind of special event, once in a while kind of thing. At least we want to be friends with God in this sense of that Aristotle talks about, this close relationship. Like any relationship, we need to kind of nurture that.
So I have a question myself, actually.
Yeah.
So I think it comes to this question about mutual goodwill, the definition of friendship. So if you're a good person,
right,
but you're not perfect, there's going to, and you have a friend who's good, but who's also not perfect.
Right.
There's going to be things that are bad about you, right? Parts of you that are perfect. So if friends, though, if they will the good for each other, but one good that they don't want to will pain to a friend, right? But sometimes they know that if they're honest, for instance, about this character trait that they have, it could like threaten the friendship. I'm wondering how does the willing of something that could be painful to a friend relate to the willing of good? And that's not just when there's something wrong with the friend, but it could be, suppose for instance I'm sick, and I know that if I tell my friend that I'm sick, it's going to cause that person a lot of pain, right? Just that sometimes maybe men especially are very reticent to share about like sickness or illness or something like that. What would Aristotle or Aquinas or you, I mean, how would this sort of circumstance?
Yeah, I guess if you're a virtuous person, part of that is having practical wisdom. And part of the virtue of practical wisdom is taking into account all the concrete circumstances of your particular situation. So that would be who you are, who your friend is, what exactly is going on in your life, what exactly the problem is, etc. And that would include, at least for Aquinas, prudence includes foresight. That is to say, a reasonable, likely understanding of the consequences that are going to happen if you tell the person whatever you want to tell the person. And so if you had practical wisdom, not perfectly, but you had it, then it seems to me that you would know in the concrete circumstances, okay, well, this person at this time, given these circumstances, I should really tell them, oh my gosh, you know, this or that, even if it's painful for them, because I know, given all the circumstances, that this actually will serve this person's well-being. On the other hand, in the concrete circumstances, you might come to the conclusion, no, you know, you don't need to reveal this. Because I do think, again, the virtuous activity is what? It's the golden mean. And so it's a mean between, on the one hand, say, in terms of honesty, there's brutal honesty. And that's not really the mean. I mean, to be a friend of someone is not to tell them every single fault they have, every problem. You know, your eyebrows are a little off. And well, yeah, okay, fine. But what? You really got to tell me about my eyebrows? Leave it alone. Just, I don't, you know, that's just too much. Brutal honesty. And then on the other hand, being dishonest and Pollyannish, right? And concealing things that you really should reveal. But the virtuous person, right, strikes the mean using practical wisdom in the concrete circumstances. Okay, well, in this case, I ought to tell her that, whatever, there's a stain on her blouse or whatever. Who knows? You know, whatever it is, right? But yeah, I don't think there's a specific answer outside of all the concrete circumstances. Yeah, so for Aristotle and Aquinas, both, the person of practical wisdom has a good end in mind. That is to say, they really want, say, your own well-being. So they've got a good goal. And then, in addition to that, they use their foresight and they use their memory of what's happened in the past, and they are docile and they learn what wise people have said about this thing, and they take into account all this information, and then they're able to figure out what actually really does serve your well-being in this concrete circumstance, given all the factors that are involved, etc. Now, for them, you could be clever and have a bad end. So say a thief could be clever, right? So I could steal, say I'm a thief and I want to steal from you. I may be very clever in that and figure out, okay, well, I know when she's at class and I know how to pick the lock to the door and I know where she keeps the jewelry. And so I may be really clever and shrewd and figure out all, using my intelligence, figure out, okay, this is how I'm going to steal from her. But for Aristotle and Aquinas both, that isn't actual practical wisdom. practical wisdom of its very nature on their account always and necessarily has a good end, and also always and necessarily is using a good means to get to that end. And so if you don't have both those things, they would say you might have shrewdness or cleverness, but you wouldn't really have practical wisdom. So for instance, say a devil could be shrewd and clever, manipulate people well, things like that. But a devilish person couldn't be a person of practical wisdom, because that means, on their view, having the good end and the good means to get to the end. So someone who merely has good intentions, that's great, but if that's all you had and you had no idea of how to realize those, well, you wouldn't be a person of practical wisdom. You'd be deficient on Aristotle's view.
Questions?
There's one right there.
I was just wondering if it's possible to be a good friend to one person and be a bad friend to another person. If it's like, if you're having to sacrifice your relationship with one person in order to be a good friend to another person, or just if you're a good friend, you're a good friend in general. Or if you can specify.
Well, in Aristotle's view, if you're a good friend, what that means is you would have the virtues, right? So you'd be courageous, practically wise, temperate, just, etc. And then for Aquinas, in addition to those things, you'd have infused faith, infused hope, and infused charity. Now, if you have infused charity, what that means is you love God, and in virtue of loving God, you also love everyone who's made in God's image. So Aquinas would say you don't really have charity at all unless you, in fact, also love all other human beings. Now, clearly, given human limitations, we can't actually do good things for all human beings, right? We don't have time and energy to help everybody in the world. But in principle, if the occasion arose, we would want to, and we would help whoever happened to need our help, right? And so for Aquinas, the person with charity really loves everyone. And in particular, the person with charity loves those that are closest related to that person with charity. So in other words, say I'm married, so I should, on Aquinas' view, have a special love, an intense love, in particular for my own wife. And I've got kids, so I should have a special love, a particular love for my own children. And I should love all of you. But there's a kind of order of love, right, where I should love everyone, but I should have special love for my kids. And if I loved you guys more than I love my own kids, that would be a disorder for Aquinas. So how does this relate to cases I think you have in mind where you might have to terminate a friendship, not be a good friend to someone in virtue of something else? Well, I think Aquinas would say that may be justified, right? There could be cases where out of love for your husband or your wife, you aren't friends with someone anymore, right? I mean, imagine a situation where you're married and you're friends with somebody and you start flirting and the one thing leads to another and you know, gosh, I'm going down a road that's going to lead to adultery. I think you'd say, well, this is not a friendship you should have. You should just, I mean, not be rude to the person or punch them in the face, but just say, hey, I can't make lunch. It'd be great, but I'm just really busy. I can't make lunch. Sorry. Right? Because you foresee, if you have practical wisdom, you foresee things. You say, aha, if I go to lunch with this person, and then maybe go to dinner with the person, have a drink with the person, and then all of a sudden I'm going down a road that leads to adultery. Okay, I don't want to do that, so I'm going to not be friends with the person. Again, that doesn't mean being rude. It just means being practically wise and say, look, this is an occasion of sin. I'm not gonna get head that way, right? And you have to do that sometimes, right, if you're married, right? And you might have to do that even if you're not married and you just have a friend or someone who could be your friend who you think is going to lead you places where you don't want to go. You might have to say, well, I just think, and again, not necessarily that you're going to be rude to them, but just, you can drift away from someone without, being rude to them. And sometimes that's justified. So friendship, unlike charity, is for everybody, but friendship isn't, right? Friendship is for particular people, it's impossible to be friends with everyone, at least if we use Aristotle's understanding, because we can't do shared activity with everyone. And if they're not a person of virtue, we couldn't have the deepest kind of friendship with them anyway. Right.
That would seem to be an example of both a relationship that is completely unequal, right? You could never be equal with God in the sense that we're equal with our human friends.
Right.
And also a case in which the the sort of virtue discrepancy is infinite.
Yeah.
And yet, we are supposed to model ourselves on the relationships that he has, that are shown to us in the Bible. So I don't think Aristotle would have been able to deal with that whole situation. As you said, God is so far above, there's no way we could be friends. But how does that aspect of Jesus' relationship with us relate to our friendships with other people?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, yeah, when Jesus says, I don't call you servants, I call you friends, I agree with you. I think that's a very significant verse. I think it's the Gospel of John. I agree, that's a very significant verse. So what does that mean? Well, I think what a Aquinas' way of thinking about it would be something like this, that by nature, we're not friends with God. We're just, by nature, God, of course, is so far above us. But what happens with grace is that we can become friends of God. In fact, we become children of God. So there's some people that are children biologically, right? Their parents conceive a child and they raise a child. I'm adopted, so I didn't become a Kaiser through biology. I became a Kaiser through adoption. I was a baby there. They went in and picked me out. And I've seen pictures of myself back then. I have no idea why they picked me. I would have not picked me. Didn't look very good. But anyway, they did. I'm very grateful. So they picked me out, brought me home, and that's what made me a member of their family, right? And God adopts us, and it's not our work. We're like that baby in the orphanage that, you know, doesn't have parents yet, and God goes in there and adopts us. And it's God's grace that makes us adopted children of God. And in becoming adopted children of God, God gives us, as part of this adoption, the grace of these infused virtues, infused faith, hope, and love, and infused justice, infused courage, temperance, and practical wisdom. That's part of the gift that God gives us in adopting us as children of God. So when Jesus calls them friends, I think he means that they're really his friends. They have shared activity, right? Jesus loves God the Father, and his shared friends share that activity, right? They love God the Father also. They have a shared emotional life, right? When Jesus is distressed in the garden, they're distressed in the garden, at least before they fall asleep. But certainly at the crucifixion, they were distressed. Jesus was distressed. I'm sure at the resurrection, they were completely overjoyed. And Jesus was overjoyed, I'm sure, to be resurrected. So they share this emotional life with Jesus. And they share in his activity. What did Jesus do when he was here on earth? Well, he did lots of things. But one of the things he did is teach. And think how the apostles went out and taught the whole world, and how many of us are teachers, carrying on the ministry of Jesus in teaching. Jesus healed people that were sick. And again, what did the apostles do? They went out and healed people that were sick. And many Christians today carry on this ministry of healing people that are sick by being doctors and lawyers and doctors and nurses and having hospitals, right? Jesus proclaimed the kingdom of God and called for repentance. Again, people in the church, his friends, continue to do that today. So I think Jesus is talking in a very literal sense that we are his friends if we do what he asks, right? If we love God, if we love neighbor, we're his friends, right? I think that's a literal truth. And the deeper and more important truth is that we're not just friends. We're his brothers, his sisters. We're adopted children of the Father. That's the deeper and more significant truth. That's much deeper than friendship.